Part 2. My Ainsel. Chapter 9. Not to mention mythic creatures in the rubble. Wendy Cope, a policeman's lot. As they drove out of Illinois late that evening, Shadow asked Wednesday his first question. He saw the welcome to Wisconsin sign and said, "So who were the guys that grabbed me in the parking lot? Mr. Wood and Mr. Stone, who were they?" The lights of the car illuminated the winter landscape. Wednesday had announced that they were not to take freeways because he didn't know whose side the freeways were on. So Shadow was sticking to back roads. He didn't mind. He wasn't even sure that Wednesday was crazy. Wednesday grunted, "Just spooks, members of the opposition, black hats." "I think," said Shadow, "that they think they're the white hats." "Of course they do. There's never been a true war that wasn't fought between two sets of people who were certain they were in the right. The really dangerous people believe that they are doing whatever they are doing solely and only because it is without question the right thing to do. And that is what makes them dangerous." "And you?" asked Shadow. "Why are you doing what you're doing?" "Because I want to," said Wednesday. And then he grinned. "So that's all right." Shadow said, "How did you all get away? Or did you all get away?"
"We did," said Wednesday, "although it was a close thing. If they'd not stopped to grab you, they might have taken the lot of us. It convinced several of the people who had been sitting on the fence that I might not be completely crazy."
"So how did you get out?"
Wednesday shook his head. "I don't pay you to ask questions," he said. "I've told you before."
Shadow shrugged.
They spent the night in a Super 8 motel south of La Crosse. Christmas Day was spent on the road, driving north and east. The farmland became pine forest. The towns seemed to come farther and farther apart. They ate their Christmas lunch late in the afternoon in a hall-like family restaurant in northern central Wisconsin. Shadow picked cheerlessly at the dried turkey, jam-sweet red lumps of cranberry sauce, tough-as-wood roasted potatoes, and the violently green canned peas. From the way he attacked it, and the way he smacked his lips, Wednesday seemed to be enjoying the food. As the meal progressed, he became positively expansive, talking, joking, and, whenever she came close enough, flirting with the waitress, a thin blonde girl who looked scarcely old enough to have dropped out of high school. "Excuse me, my dear, but might I trouble you for another cup of your delightful hot chocolate, and I trust you won't think me too forward if I say what a mightily fetching and becoming dress that is, festive yet classy." The waitress, who wore a bright red and green skirt edged with glittering silver tinsel, giggled and colored and smiled happily, and went off to get Wednesday another mug of hot chocolate.
"Fetching," said Wednesday thoughtfully, watching her go.
"Becoming," he said.
Shadow did not think he was talking about the dress. Wednesday shoveled the final slice of turkey into his mouth, flicked at his beard with his napkin, and pushed his plate forward.
"Ah, good."
He looked around him at the family restaurant. In the background, a tape of Christmas songs was playing. The little drummer boy had no gifts to bring. Pa-ra-pa-pum-pum, ra-pa-pum-pum, ra-pa-pum-pum.
"Some things may change," said Wednesday abruptly. "People, however, people stay the same. Some grifts last forever, others are swallowed soon enough by time and by the world. My favorite grift of all is no longer practical. Still, a surprising number of grifts are timeless. The Spanish prisoner, the pigeon drop, the fawny rig, that's the pigeon drop but with a gold ring instead of a wallet, the fiddle game."
"I've never heard of the fiddle game," said Shadow. "I think I've heard of the others. My old cellmate said he'd actually done the Spanish prisoner. He was a grifter."
"Ah," said Wednesday, and his left eye sparkled. "The fiddle game was a fine and wonderful con. In its purest form, it is a two-man grift. It trades on cupidity and greed, as all great grifts do. You can always cheat an honest man, but it takes more work. So, we are in a hotel, or an inn, or a fine restaurant, and dining there we find a man.
shabby, but shabby genteel, not down at heel, but certainly down on his luck. We shall call him Abraham. And when the time comes to settle his bill, not a huge bill, you understand, $50-$75, an embarrassment. Where is his wallet? Good Lord, he must have left it at a friend's, not far away. He shall go and obtain his wallet forthwith. But here, mine host, says Abraham, take this old fiddle of mine for security. It's old, as you can see, but it's how I make my living. Wednesday's smile, when he saw the waitress approaching, was huge and predatory. Ah, the hot chocolate, brought to me by my Christmas angel. Tell me, my dear, could I have some more of your delicious bread when you get a moment? The waitress, what was she, Shadow wondered, 16, 17, looked at the floor, and her cheeks flushed crimson. She put down the chocolate with shaking hands and retreated to the edge of the room by the slowly rotating display of pies, where she stopped and stared at Wednesday. Then she slipped into the kitchen to fetch Wednesday his bread. So, the violin, old, unquestionably, perhaps even a little battered, is placed away in its case, and our temporarily impecunious Abraham sets off in search of his wallet. But a well-dressed gentleman, only just done with his own dinner, has been observing this exchange, and now he approaches our host. Could he, perchance, inspect the violin that honest Abraham left behind? Certainly he can. Our host hands it over, and the well-dressed man, let us call him Barrington, opens his mouth wide, then remembers himself and closes it, examines the violin reverentially, like a man who has been permitted into a holy sanctum to examine the bones of a prophet. "Why," he says, "this is... it must be... no, it cannot be. But yes, there it is, my lord, but this is unbelievable." And he points to the maker's mark on a strip of browning paper inside the violin. "But still," he says, "even without it, he would have known it by the color of the varnish, by the scroll, by the shape." Now, Barrington reaches inside his pocket and produces an engraved business card, proclaiming him to be a preeminent dealer in rare and antique musical instruments. "So this violin is rare?" asks mine host. "Indeed it is," says Barrington, still admiring it with awe, "and worth in excess of $100,000, unless I miss my guess. Even as a dealer in such things, I would pay $75,000, good cash money, for such an exquisite piece. I have a man on the West Coast who would buy it tomorrow, sight unseen, with one telegram, and pay whatever I asked for it." And then he consults his watch, and his face falls. "My train," he says. "I have scarcely enough time to catch my train. Good sir, when the owner of this inestimable instrument should return, please give him my card, for, alas, I must be away." And with that Barrington leaves, a man who knows that time and the train wait for no man. Mine host examines the violin, curiosity mingling with cupidity in his veins, and a plan begins to bubble up through his mind. But the minutes go by, and Abraham does not return. And now it is late, and through the door, shabby but proud, comes our Abraham, our fiddle player, and he holds in his hands a wallet that has seen better days, a wallet that has never contained more than $100 on its best day, and from it he takes the money to pay for his meal or his stay, and he asks for the return of his violin. Mine host puts the fiddle in its case on the counter, and Abraham takes it like a mother cradling her child. "Tell me," says the host, with the engraved card of a man who'll pay $50,000, good cash money, burning in his inside breast pocket, "how much is a violin like this worth? For my niece has a yearning on her to play the fiddle, and it's her birthday coming up in a week or so." "Sell this fiddle?" says Abraham. "I could never sell her. I've had her for 20 years, I have. Fiddled in every state of the Union with her, and to tell the truth, she cost me all of $500 back when I bought her." Mine host keeps the smile from his face. $500? "What if I were to offer you $1,000 for it, here and now?" The fiddle player looks delighted, then crestfallen, and he says, "But, Lordy, I'm a fiddle player, sir. It's all I know how to do. This fiddle knows me, and she loves me, and my fingers know her so well I could play an air upon her in the dark. Where will I find another that sounds so fine? $1,000 is good money, but this is my livelihood. Not $1,000, not for 5,000. Mine host sees his profits shrinking, but this is business, and you must spend money to make money. $8,000, he says. It's not worth that, but I've taken a fancy to it, and I do love and indulge my niece." Abraham is almost in tears at the thought of losing his beloved fiddle, but how can he say no to $8,000, especially when mine host goes to the wall safe and removes not eight, but $9,000, all neatly banded and ready to be slipped into the fiddle player's threadbare pocket. "You're a good man," he tells his host. "You're a saint. But you must swear to take care of my girl," and reluctantly he hands over his violin. But what if mine host simply hands over Barrington's card and tells Abraham that he's come into some good fortune? Asked Shadow.
"Then we're out the cost of two dinners," said Wednesday.
He wiped the remaining gravy and leftovers from his plate with a slice of bread, which he ate with lip-smacking relish. "Let me see if I've got it straight," said Shadow. "So Abraham leaves, $9,000 the richer, and in the parking lot by the train station he and Barrington meet up. They split the money, get into Barrington's Model A Ford, and head for the next town. I guess in the trunk of that car they must have a box filled with $100 violins.
I personally made it a point of honor never to pay more than $5 for any of them," said Wednesday.
Then he turned to the hovering waitress.
"Now, my dear, regale us with your description of the sumptuous desserts available to us on this our Lord's natal day."
He stared at her. It was almost a leer, as if nothing that she could offer him would be as toothsome a morsel as herself. Shadow felt deeply uncomfortable. It was like watching an old wolf stalking a fawn, too young to know that if it did not run and run now, it would wind up in a distant glade with its bones picked clean by the ravens. The girl blushed once more and told them that dessert was apple pie a la mode.
"That's with a scoop of vanilla ice cream."
"Christmas cake a la mode, or a red and green whipped pudding." Wednesday stared into her eyes and told her that he would try the Christmas cake a la mode. Shadow passed.
"Now, as grifts go," said Wednesday, "the fiddle game goes back 300 years or more, and if you pick your chicken correctly, you could still play it anywhere in America tomorrow."
"I thought you said that your favorite grift was no longer practical," said Shadow.
"I did indeed. However, that is not my favorite. No, my favorite was one they called the Bishop game. It had everything. Excitement, subterfuge, portability, surprise. Perhaps, I think from time to time, perhaps with a little modification it might—"
He thought for a moment, then shook his head.
"No, its time has passed. It is, let us say, 1920. In a city of medium to large size, Chicago perhaps, or New York, or Philadelphia. We are in a jeweler's emporium. A man dressed as a clergyman— and not just any clergyman, but a bishop, in his purple, enters and picks out a necklace, a gorgeous and glorious confection of diamonds and pearls, and pays for it with a dozen of the crispest $100 bills. There's a smudge of green ink on the topmost bill, and the store owner, apologetically but firmly, sends the stack of bills to the bank on the corner to be checked. Soon enough the store clerk returns with the bills. The bank says they are none of them counterfeit. The owner apologizes again, and the bishop is most gracious. He well understands the problem. There are such lawless and ungodly types in the world today, such immorality and lewdness abroad in the world, and shameless women. And now that the underworld has crawled out of the gutter and come to live on the screens of the picture palaces, what more could anyone expect? And the necklace is placed in its case. And the store owner does his best not to ponder why a bishop of the church would be purchasing a $1,200 diamond necklace, nor why he would be paying good cash money for it. The bishop bids him a hearty farewell and walks out on the street, only for a heavy hand to descend on his shoulder. "Why, Soapy, yez spalpeen, up to your old tricks, are ye?" And a broad-beat cop with an honest Irish face walks the bishop back into the jewelry store.
"Begging your pardon, but has this man just bought anything from you?" asks the cop. "Certainly not," says the bishop. "Tell him I have not." "Indeed he has," says the jeweler. "He bought a pearl and diamond necklace from me, paid for it in cash as well." "Would you have the bills available, sir?" asks the cop. So the jeweler takes the $1,200 bills from the cash register and hands them to the cop, who holds them up to the light and shakes his head in wonder. "Oh, soapy, soapy," he says. "These are the finest that you've made yet. You're a craftsman, that you are." A self-satisfied smile spreads across the bishop's face. "You can't prove nothing," says the bishop. "And the bank said that they were on the level. It's the real green stuff." "I'm sure they did," agrees the cop on the beat. "But I doubt that the bank had been warned that Soapy Sylvester was in town, nor of the quality of the $100 bills he'd been passing in Denver and in St. Louis." And with that he reaches into the bishop's pocket and pulls out the necklace. $1,200 worth of diamonds and pearls in exchange for 50 cents worth of paper and ink," says the policeman, who is obviously a philosopher at heart. "And passing yourself off as a man of the church, you should be ashamed," he says, as he claps the handcuffs on the bishop, who is obviously no bishop, and he marches him away, but not before he gives the jeweler a receipt for both the necklace and the 1,200 counterfeit dollars. It's evidence, after all.
"Was it really counterfeit?" asked Shadow.
"Of course not. Fresh banknotes, straight from the bank, only with a thumbprint and a smudge of green ink on a couple of them to make them a little more interesting."
Shadow sipped his coffee. It was worse than prison coffee. So the cop was obviously no cop. And the necklace?
"Evidence," said Wednesday.
He unscrewed the top from the salt shaker, poured a little heap of salt on the table.
"But the jeweler gets a receipt and assurance that he'll get the necklace straight back as soon as Soapy comes to trial. He is congratulated on being a good citizen, and he watches proudly, already thinking of the tale he'll have to tell at the next meeting of the Odd Fellows tomorrow night, as the policeman marches the man, pretending to be a bishop, out of the store, $1,200 in one pocket, a $1,200 diamond necklace in the other, on their way to a police station that'll never see hide nor hair of either of them."
The waitress had returned to clear the table.
"Tell me, my dear," said Wednesday, "are you married?"
She shook her head.
"Astonishing that a young lady of such loveliness has not yet been snapped up."
He was doodling with his fingernail in the spilled salt, making squat, blocky, rune-like shapes. The waitress stood passively beside him, reminding Shadow less of a fawn and more of a young rabbit, caught in an 18-wheeler's headlights, frozen in fear and indecision. Wednesday lowered his voice, so much so that Shadow only across the table could barely hear him.
"What time do you get off work?"
9, she said, and swallowed. 9:30 latest.
"And what is the finest motel in this area?"
"There's a Motel 6, she said. "It's not much."
Wednesday touched the back of her hand fleetingly with the tips of his fingers, leaving crumbs of salt on her skin. She made no attempt to wipe them off.
"To us," he said, his voice an almost inaudible rumble, "it shall be a pleasure palace."
The waitress looked at him. She bit her thin lips, hesitated, then nodded, and fled for the kitchen.
"Come on," said Shadow. "She looks barely legal."
"I've never been overly concerned about legality," Wednesday told him. "And I need her, not as an end in herself, but to wake me up a little. Even King David knew that there is one easy prescription to get warm blood flowing through an old frame. Take one virgin, call me in the morning." Shadow caught himself wondering if the girl on night duty in the hotel back in Eagle Point had been a virgin. "Don't you ever worry about disease?" he asked. "What if you knock her up? What if she's got a brother?"
"No," said Wednesday, "I don't worry about diseases. I don't catch them.
Unfortunately, for the most part, people like me fire blanks, so there's not a great deal of interbreeding. It used to happen in the old days. Nowadays it's possible, but so unlikely as to be almost unimaginable. So no worries there, and many girls have brothers and fathers. It's not my problem. 99 times out of 100, I've left town already.
So we're staying here for the night?
Wednesday rubbed his chin. I shall stay in the Motel 6, he said. Then he put his hand into his coat pocket. He pulled out a front door key, bronze-colored, with a card tag attached on which was typed an address, 502 Northridge Road, apartment number 3. You, on the other hand, have an apartment waiting for you in a city far from here. Wednesday closed his eyes for a moment. Then he opened them, gray and gleaming and fractionally mismatched, and he said, "The Greyhound bus will be coming through town in 20 minutes. It stops at the gas station. Here's your ticket." He pulled out a folded bus ticket, passed it across the table. Shadow picked it up and looked at it. "Who's Mike Ainsell?" he asked. That was the name on the ticket. "You are. Happy Christmas."
"And where's Lakeside?"
"Your happy home in the months to come. And now, because good things come in threes..." He took a small, gift-wrapped package from his pocket, pushed it across the table. It sat beside the ketchup bottle with the black smears of dried ketchup on the top. Shadow made no move to take it.
"Well?"
Reluctantly, Shadow tore open the red wrapping paper to reveal a fawn-colored calf-skin wallet, shiny from use. It was obviously somebody's wallet. Inside the wallet was a driver's license with Shadow's photograph on it, in the name of Michael Ainsell, with a Milwaukee address, a MasterCard for M. Ainsell, and 20 crisp $50 bills. Shadow closed the wallet, put it into an inside pocket.
"Thanks," he said.
"Think of it as a Christmas bonus. Now, let me walk you down to the Greyhound. I shall wave to you as you ride the Grey Dog north."
They walked outside the restaurant.
Shadow found it hard to believe how much colder it had gotten in the last few hours. It felt too cold to snow now. Aggressively cold. This was a bad winter.
"Hey, Wednesday, both of the scams you were telling me about, the violin scam and the bishop one, the bishop and the cop..."
He hesitated, trying to form his thought, to bring it into focus.
"What of them?"
Then he had it. "They're both two-man scams, one guy on each side.
Did you used to have a partner?"
Shadow's breath came in clouds. He promised himself that when he got to Lakeside, he would spend some of his Christmas bonus on the warmest, thickest winter coat that money could buy.
"Yes," said Wednesday. "Yes, I had a partner, a junior partner. But alas, those days are gone. There's the gas station, and there, unless my eye deceives me, is the bus."
It was already signaling its turn into the parking lot.
"Your address is on the key," said Wednesday. "If anyone asks, I am your uncle, and I shall be rejoicing in the unlikely name of Emerson Borson."
"Settle in Lakeside, nephew Ainsell. I'll come for you within a week. We shall be traveling together, visiting the people I have to visit. In the meantime, keep your head down and stay out of trouble."
"My car?" said Shadow. "I'll take good care of it. Have a good time in Lakeside," said Wednesday.
He thrust out his hand, and Shadow shook it. Wednesday's hand was colder than a corpse's.
"Jesus," said Shadow, "you're cold."
"Then, the sooner I am making the two-backed beast with the little hutsy-totsy lass from the restaurant in a back room of the Motel 6, the better." And he reached out his other hand and squeezed Shadow's shoulder. Shadow experienced a dizzying moment of double vision. He saw the grizzled man facing him, squeezing his shoulder, but he saw something else. So many winters. Hundreds and hundreds of winters. And a gray man in a broad-brimmed hat, walking from settlement to settlement, leaning on his staff, staring in through windows at the firelight, at a joy and a burning life he would never be able to touch. Never even be able to feel.
"Go," said Wednesday, his voice a reassuring growl. "All is well. And all is well. And all shall be well."
Shadow showed his ticket to the driver.
"Hell of a day to be traveling,"
she said, and then she added, with a certain grim satisfaction, "Merry Christmas." The bus was almost empty. "When will we get into Lakeside?" asked Shadow.
2 hours, maybe a bit more," said the driver. "They say there's a cold snap coming."
She thumbed a switch, and the doors closed with a hiss and a thump. Shadow walked halfway down the bus, put the seat back as far as it would go, and he started to think. The motion of the bus and the warmth combined to lull him, and before he was aware that he was becoming sleepy, he was asleep. In the earth, and under the earth, the marks on the wall were the red of wet clay, handprints, finger marks, and here and there crude representations of animals and people and birds. The fire still burned, and the buffalo man still sat on the other side of the fire, staring at Shadow with huge eyes, eyes like pools of dark mud. The buffalo lips, fringed with matted brown hair, didn't move as the buffalo voice said, "Well, Shadow, do you believe yet?" "I don't know," said Shadow. His mouth had not moved either, he observed. Whatever words were passing between the two of them were not being spoken, not in any way that Shadow understood speech. "Are you real?"
"Believe," said the buffalo man.
"Are you—" Shadow hesitated, and then he asked, "Are you a god, too?" The buffalo man reached one hand into the flames of the fire, and he pulled out a burning brand. He held the brand in the middle. Blue and yellow flames licked his red hand, but they did not burn.
"This is not a land for gods," said the buffalo man.
But it was not the buffalo man talking any more, Shadow knew, in his dream. It was the fire speaking, the crackling and the burning of the flame itself that spoke to Shadow in the dark place under the earth.
"This land was brought up from the depths of the ocean by a diver," said the fire. "It was spun from its own substance by a spider. It was shat by a raven. It is the body of a fallen father, whose bones are mountains, whose eyes are lakes. This is a land of dreams and fire," said the flame.
The buffalo man put the brand back on the fire.
"Why are you telling me this stuff?" said Shadow. "I'm not important. I'm not anything. I was an okay physical trainer, a really lousy small-time crook, and maybe not so good a husband as I thought I was."
He trailed off.
"How do I help Laura?" Shadow asked the buffalo man. "She wants to be alive again. I said I'd help her. I owe her that."
The buffalo man said nothing. He pointed up toward the roof of the cave. Shadow's eyes followed. There was a thin, wintry light coming from a tiny opening far above.
"Up there?" asked Shadow, wishing that one of his questions would be answered. "I'm supposed to go up there?"
The dream took him then, the idea becoming the thing itself, and Shadow was crushed into the rock and earth. He was like a mole, trying to push through the earth, like a badger climbing through the earth, like a groundhog pushing the earth out of his way, like a bear. But the earth was too hard, too dense, and his breath was coming in gasps, and soon he could go no further, dig and climb no more, and he knew then that he would die, somewhere in the deep place beneath the world. His own strength was not enough. His efforts became weaker. He knew that though his body was riding in a hot bus through cold woods, if he stopped breathing here beneath the world, he would stop breathing there as well. That even now his breath was coming in shallow, panting gasps. He struggled and he pushed, ever more weakly, each movement using precious air. He was trapped, could go no further, and could not return the way that he had come.
"Now, bargain," said a voice in his mind.
"What do I have to bargain with?" Shadow asked. "I have nothing."
He could taste the clay now, thick and mud-gritty in his mouth. And then Shadow said,
"Except myself. I have myself, don't I?"
It seemed as if everything was holding its breath. I offer myself, he said. The response was immediate. The rocks and the earth that had surrounded him began to push down on Shadow, squeezed him so hard that the last ounce of air in his lungs was crushed out of him. The pressure became pain, pushing him on every side. He reached the zenith of pain and hung there, cresting, knowing that he could take no more. At that moment, the spasm eased, and Shadow could breathe again. The light above him had grown larger. He was being pushed toward the surface. As the next earth spasm hit, Shadow tried to ride with it. This time he felt himself being pushed upward. The pain on that last awful contraction was impossible to believe as he felt himself being squeezed, crushed, and pushed through an unyielding rock gap, his bones shattering, his flesh becoming something shapeless. As his mouth and ruined head cleared the hole, he began to scream in fear and pain. He wondered, as he screamed, whether back in the waking world he was also screaming. If he was screaming in his sleep, back on the darkened bus. And as that final spasm ended, Shadow was on the ground, his fingers clutching the red earth. He pulled himself into a sitting position, wiped the earth from his face with his hand, and looked up at the sky. It was twilight, a long, purple twilight. And the stars were coming out one by one, stars so much brighter and more vivid than any stars he had ever seen or imagined.
Soon, said the crackling voice of the flame coming from behind him, they will fall. Soon they will fall, and the star people will meet the earth people. There will be heroes among them, and men who will slay monsters and bring knowledge, but none of them will be gods. This is a poor place for gods.
A blast of air, shocking in its coldness, touched his face. It was like being doused in ice water. He could hear the driver's voice saying that they were in Pinewood. Anyone who needs a cigarette or wants to stretch their legs will be stopping here for 10 minutes, then we'll be back on the road. Shadow stumbled off the bus. They were parked outside another rural gas station, almost identical to the one they had left. The driver was helping a couple of teenage girls onto the bus, putting their suitcases away in the luggage compartment.
"Hey," the driver said when she saw Shadow, "you're getting off at Lakeside, right?"
Shadow agreed, sleepily, that he was.
"Heck, that's a good town," said the bus driver. "I think sometimes that if I were just going to pack it all in, I'd move to Lakeside. Prettiest town I've ever seen. You've lived there long?"
"My first visit."
"You have a pasty at Mabel's for me, you hear?"
Shadow decided not to ask for clarification. "Tell me," said Shadow, "was I talking in my sleep?"
"If you were, I didn't hear you."
She looked at her watch.
"Back on the bus. I'll call you when we get to Lakeside."
The two girls, he doubted that either of them was much more than 14 years old, who had got on in Pinewood, were now in the seat in front of him. They were friends, Shadow decided, eavesdropping without meaning to, not sisters. One of them knew almost nothing about sex, but knew a lot about animals, helped out or spent a lot of time at some kind of animal shelter, while the other was not interested in animals, but, armed with 100 tidbits gleaned from the Internet and from daytime television, thought she knew a great deal about human sexuality. Shadow listened with a horrified and amused fascination to the one who thought she was wise in the ways of the world detail the precise mechanics of using Alka-Seltzer tablets to enhance oral sex. Shadow started to tune them out, blanked everything except the noise of the road, and now only fragments of conversation would come back every now and then.
"Goldie is like such a good dog, and he was a purebred retriever. If only my dad would say okay. He wags his tail whenever he sees me. It's Christmas. He has to let me use the snowmobile. You can write your name with your tongue on the side of his thing. I miss Sandy."
"Yeah, I miss Sandy, too."
6 inches tonight, they said, but they just make it up. They make up the weather, and nobody ever calls them on it."
And then the brakes of the bus were hissing, and the driver was shouting, "Lakeside!" And the doors clunked open. Shadow followed the girls out into the floodlit parking lot of a video store and tanning salon that functioned, Shadow guessed, as Lakeside's Greyhound Station. The air was dreadfully cold, but it was a fresh cold. It woke him up. He stared at the lights of the town to the south and the west, and pale expanse of a frozen lake to the east. The girls were standing in the lot, stamping and blowing on their hands dramatically. One of them, the younger one, snuck a look at Shadow, smiled awkwardly when she realized that he had seen her do so. "Merry Christmas," said Shadow.
"Yeah,"
said the other girl, perhaps a year or so older than the first.
"Merry Christmas to you, too."
She had carroty red hair and a snub nose covered with 100,000 freckles. "Nice town you got here," said Shadow.
"We like it," said the younger one.
She was the one who liked animals. She gave Shadow a shy grin, revealing blue rubber band braces stretching across her front teeth.
"You look like somebody," she told him gravely. "Are you somebody's brother or somebody's son or something?"
"You are such a spaz, Allison," said her friend. "Everybody's somebody's son or brother or something."
"That wasn't what I meant," said Allison.
Headlights framed them all for one brilliant white moment. Behind the headlights was a station wagon with a mother in it, and in moments it took the girls and their bags away, leaving Shadow standing alone in the parking lot.
"Young man, anything I can do for you?"
The old man was locking up the video store. He pocketed his keys.
"Store ain't open Christmas," he told Shadow cheerfully. "But I come down to meet the boss, make sure everything was okay. Couldn't live with myself if some poor soul had found themselves stranded on Christmas Day."
He was close enough that Shadow could see his face, old but contented. The face of a man who had sipped life's vinegar and found it, by and large, to be mostly whiskey, and good whiskey at that. "Well, you could give me the number of the local taxi company," said Shadow.
"I could," said the old man, doubtfully. "But Tom'll be in his bed this time of night, and even if you could rouse him, you'll get no satisfaction. I saw him down at the buck stops here earlier this evening, and he was very merry, very merry indeed. Where is it you're aiming to go?"
Shadow showed him the address tag on the door key.
"Well," he said, "that's a 10, maybe a 20-minute walk over the bridge and around, but it's no fun when it's this cold. And when you don't know where you're going, it always seems longer. You ever notice that? First time takes forever, and then ever after, it's over in a flash."
"Yes," said Shadow. "I've never thought of it like that, but I guess it's true." The old man nodded. His face cracked into a grin.
"What the heck? It's Christmas. I'll run you over there in Tessie."
Shadow followed the old man to the road, where a huge old roadster was parked. It looked like something that gangsters might have been proud to drive in the Roaring Twenties, running boards and all. It was a deep, dark color under the sodium lights that might have been red and might have been green.
"This is Tessie," the old man said. "Ain't she a beaut?"
He patted her proprietorially, with the hood curved up and arched over the front near side wheel. "What make is she?" asked Shadow.
"She's a Went Phoenix. Went went under in 31. Name was bought by Chrysler, but they never made any more Wents. Harvey Went, who founded the company, was a local boy. Went out to California, killed himself in, 1941-42. Great tragedy."
The car smelled of leather and old cigarette smoke. Not a fresh smell, but as if enough people had smoked enough cigarettes and cigars in the car over the years that the smell of burning tobacco had become part of the fabric of the car. The old man turned the key in the ignition, and Tessie started first time.
"Tomorrow," he told Shadow, "she goes into the garage. I'll cover her with a dust sheet, and that's where she'll stay until spring. Truth of the matter is, I shouldn't be driving her right now with the snow on the ground."
"Doesn't she ride well in snow?"
"Rides just fine. It's the salt they put on the roads. Rusts these old beauties faster than you could believe. You want to go door to door, or would you like the moonlight grand tour of the town?"
"I don't want to trouble you."
"It's no trouble. You get to be my age, you're grateful for the least wink of sleep. I'm lucky if I get 5 hours a night nowadays. Wake up, and my mind is just turning and turning. Where are my manners? My name's Hinselman. I'd say call me Richie, but round here folks who know me just call me plain Hinselman. I'd shake your hand, but I need two hands to drive Tessie. She knows, and I'm not paying attention."
"Mike Ainsel," said Shadow. "Pleased to meet you, Hinselman."
"So we'll go round the lake, grand tour," said Hinselman.
Main Street, which they were on, was a pretty street, even at night, and it looked old-fashioned in the best sense of the word, as if for 100 years people had been caring for that street and they had not been in a hurry to lose anything they liked. Hinselman pointed out the town's 2 restaurants as they passed them, a German restaurant, and what he described as part Greek, part Norwegian, and a popover at every plate. He pointed out the bakery and the bookstore.
"What I say is, a town isn't a town without a bookstore. It may call itself a town, but unless it's got a bookstore, it knows it's not fooling a soul."
He slowed Tessie as they passed the library, so Shadow could get a good look at it. Antique gas lights flickered over the doorway. Hinselman proudly called Shadow's attention to them.
"Built in the 1870s by John Henning, local lumber baron. He wanted it called the Henning Memorial Library, but when he died, they started calling it the Lakeside Library, and I guess it'll be the Lakeside Library now until the end of time. Isn't it a dream?"
He couldn't have been prouder of it if he had built it himself. The building reminded Shadow of a castle, and he said so.
"That's right," agreed Hinselman. "Turrets and all. Henning wanted it to look like that on the outside. Inside they still have all the original pine shelving. Miriam Schultz wants to tear the insides out and modernize, but it's on some register of historic places, and there's not a damn thing she can do."
They drove around the south side of the lake. The town circled the lake, which was a 30-foot drop below the level of the road. Shadow could see the patches of white ice dulling the surface of the lake, with here and there a shiny patch of water reflecting the lights of the town. "Looks like it's freezing over," he said.
"It's been frozen over for a month now," said Hinselman. "The dull spots are snowdrifts, and the shiny spots are ice. It froze just after Thanksgiving, in one cold night. Froze, smooth as glass. You do much ice fishing, Mr. Ainsel?"
"Never."
"Best thing a man can do is not the fish you catch. It's the peace of mind that you take home at the end of the day."
"I'll remember that."
Shadow peered down at the lake through Tessie's window. "Can you actually walk on it already?"
"You can walk on it. Drive on it, too, but I wouldn't want to risk it yet. It's been cold up here for 6 weeks, said Hinselman. "But you also got to allow that things freeze harder and faster up here in northern Wisconsin than they do most any place else there is. I was out hunting once, hunting for deer, and this was, 30, 40 years back, and I shot at a buck, missed him, and sent him running off through the woods. This was over across the north end of the lake, up near where you'll be living, Mike. Now, he was the finest buck I ever did see. 20-point, big as a small horse, no lie. Now, I'm younger and feistier back then than I am now, and though it had started snowing before Halloween that year, now it was Thanksgiving, and there was clean snow on the ground, fresh as anything, and I could see the buck's footprints. It looked to me like the big fellow was heading for the lake in a panic. Well, only a damn fool tries to run down a buck, but there am I, a damn fool, running after him, and there he is, standing in the lake in, 8, 9 inches of water, and he's just looking at me. That very moment, the sun goes behind a cloud, and the freeze comes. Temperature must have fallen 30 degrees in 10 minutes. Not a word of a lie. And that old stag, he gets ready to run, and he can't move. He's frozen into the ice. Me, I just walk over to him slowly. You can see he wants to run, but he's iced in, and it just isn't going to happen. But there's no way I can bring myself to shoot a defenseless critter when he can't get away. What kind of man would I be if I'd done that, eh? So I takes my shotgun, and I fires off one shell straight up into the air. Well, the noise and the shock is enough to make that buck just about jump out of his skin, and seeing that his legs are iced in, that's just what he proceeds to do. He leaves his hide and his antlers stuck to the ice while he charges back into the woods, pink as a newborn mouse and shivering fit to bust. I felt bad enough for that old buck that I talked the Lakeside Ladies' Knitting Circle into making him something warm to wear all the winter, and they knitted him an all-over one-piece woolen suit so he wouldn't freeze to death. Of course, the joke was on us because they knitted him a suit of bright orange wool so no hunter ever shot at it. Hunters in these parts wear orange at hunting season.
he added helpfully. "And if you think there's a word of a lie in that, I can prove it to you. I've got the antlers up on my rec room wall to this day."
Shadow laughed, and the old man smiled the satisfied smile of a master craftsman. They pulled up outside a brick building with a large wooden deck from which golden holiday lights hung and twinkled invitingly.
"That's 502, said Hinselman. "Apartment 3 would be on the top floor around the other side overlooking the lake. There you go, Mike."
"Thank you, Mr. Hinselman. Can I give you anything toward gas?"
"Just Hinselman, and you don't owe me a penny. Merry Christmas from me and from Tessie."
"Are you sure you won't accept anything?"
The old man scratched his chin. "Tell you what," he said. "Sometime in the next week or so, I'll come by and sell you some tickets for our raffle. Charity. For now, young man, you can be getting on a bed."
Shadow smiled. "Merry Christmas, Hinselman," he said. The old man shook Shadow's hand with one red-knuckled hand. It felt as hard and as calloused as an oak branch.
"Now you watch the path as you go up there. It's going to be slippery. I can see your door from here at the side there. See it? I'll just wait in the car down here until you're safely inside. You just give me the thumbs up when you're in okay, and I'll drive off."
He kept the Went idling until Shadow was safely up the wooden steps on the side of the house, had opened the apartment door with his key. The door to the apartment swung open. Shadow made a thumbs-up sign, and the old man in the Went, Tessie, thought Shadow, and the thought of a car with a name made him smile one more time. Hinselman and Tessie swung around and made their way back across the bridge. Shadow shut the front door. The room was freezing. It smelled of people who had gone away to live other lives, and of all they had eaten and dreamed. He found the thermostat and cranked it up to 70 degrees. He went into the tiny kitchen, checked the drawers, opened the avocado-colored refrigerator, but it was empty. No surprise there. At least the fridge smelled clean inside, not musty. There was a small bedroom with a bare mattress in it, beside the kitchen, next to an even tinier bathroom that was mostly shower stall. An aged cigarette butt sat in the toilet bowl, staining the water brown. Shadow flushed it away. He found sheets and blankets in a closet and made the bed. Then he took off his shoes, his jacket, and his watch, and he climbed into the bed, fully dressed, wondering how long it would take him to get warm. The lights were off, and there was silence, mostly, nothing but the hum of the refrigerator, and somewhere in the building a radio playing. He lay there in the darkness, wondering if he had slept himself out on the Greyhound, if the hunger and the cold and the new bed and the craziness of the last few weeks would combine to keep him awake that night. In the stillness he heard something snap, like a shot. A branch, he thought, or the ice. It was freezing out there. He wondered how long he would have to wait until Wednesday came for him. A day? A week? However long he had, he knew he had to focus on something in the meantime. He would start to work out again, he decided, and practice his coin slights and palms until he was smooth as anything. "Practice all your tricks," somebody whispered inside his head, in a voice that was not his own. "All of them but one. Not the trick that poor dead Mad Sweeney showed you, dead of exposure and the cold and of being forgotten. And surplus to requirements, not that trick. Oh, not that one." But this was a good town, he could feel it. He thought of his dream, if it had been a dream, that first night in Cairo. He thought of Zoria. What the hell was her name? The Midnight Sister. And then he thought of Laura. It was as if thinking of her opened a window in his mind. He could see her. He could somehow see her. She was in Eagle Point, in the backyard outside her mother's big house. She stood in the cold, which she did not feel any more, or which she felt all the time. She stood outside the house that her mother had bought in 1989 with the insurance money after Laura's father, Harvey McCabe, had passed on, a heart attack while straining on the can, and she was staring in, her cold hands pressed against the glass, her breath not fogging it, not at all, watching her mother and her sister and her sister's children and husband in from Texas, home for Christmas. Out in the darkness. That was where Laura was.
unable not to look. Tears prickled in Shadow's eyes, and he rolled over in his bed. He felt like a peeping Tom. Turned his thoughts away, willed them to come back to him. He could see the lake spread out below him as the wind blew down from the Arctic, prying Jack Frost fingers 100 times colder than the fingers of any corpse. Shadow's breath came shallowly now. He could hear a wind rising, a bitter screaming around the house, and for a moment he thought he could hear words on the wind. If he was going to be anywhere, he might as well be here, he thought. And then he slept. Meanwhile, a conversation.
Ding-dong. Miss Crow?
Yes.
Miss Samantha Black Crow?
Yes.
Do you mind if we ask you a few questions, ma'am?
Are you cops? What are you?
My name is Town. My colleague here is Mr. Rode. We're investigating the disappearance of two of our associates.
What were their names?
I'm sorry.
Tell me their names. I want to know what they were called, your associates. Tell me their names, and maybe I'll help you.
Okay, their names are Mr. Stone and Mr. Wood. Now, can we ask you some questions?
Do you guys just see things and pick names? Oh, you be Mr. Sidewalk, he's Mr. Carpet. Say hello to Mr. Airplane.
Very funny, young lady. First question, we need to know if you've seen this man. Here, you can hold the photograph.
Whoa, straight on and profile, with numbers on the bottom and big. He's cute, though. What did he do?
He was mixed up in a small-town bank robbery as a driver some years ago. His two colleagues decided to keep all the loot for themselves and ran out on him. He got angry, found them, came close to killing them with his hands. The state cut a deal with the men he hurt. They testified against him. Shadow here got 6 years. He served 3. You ask me, guys like that, they should just lock them up and throw away the key.
I've never heard anyone say that in real life, you know. Not out loud.
Say what, Miss Crow?
Loot. It's not a word you ever hear people say. Maybe in movies people say it, not for real.
This isn't a movie, Miss Crow.
Black Crow. It's Ms. Black Crow. My friends call me Sam.
Got it, Sam. Now about this man.
But you aren't my friends. You can call me Ms. Black Crow.
Listen, you snot-nosed little... It's okay, Mr. Rode. Sam here. Pardon, ma'am. I mean, Ms. Black Crow wants to help us. She's a law-abiding citizen.
Ma'am, we know you helped Shadow. You were seen with him in a white Chevy Nova. He gave you a ride. He bought you dinner. Did he say anything that could help us in our investigation? Two of our best men have vanished.
I never met him.
You met him. Please don't make the mistake of thinking we're stupid. We aren't stupid.
I meet a lot of people. Maybe I met him and forgot already.
Ma'am, it really is to your advantage to cooperate with us.
Otherwise you'll have to introduce me to your friends, Mr. Thumbscrews and Mr. Pentathol.
Ma'am, you aren't making this any easier on yourself.
Gee, I'm sorry. Now, is there anything else? Because I'm going to say bye-bye now and close the door, and I figure you two are going to go and get into Mr. Carr and drive away.
Your lack of cooperation has been noted, ma'am.
Bye-bye now. Click.
This ends Disc 8. American Gods, Disc 9.
Chapter 10.
I'll tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. So send me off to bed forevermore.
Tom Waits. Tango till they're sore.
A whole life in darkness, surrounded by filth. That was what Shadow dreamed his first night in Lakeside. A child's life, long ago and far away, in a land across the ocean, in the lands where the sun rose. But this life contained no sunrises, only dimness by day and blindness by night. Nobody spoke to him. He heard human voices from outside, but could understand human speech no better than he understood the howling of the owls or the yelps of dogs. He remembered
or thought he remembered, one night, half a lifetime ago, when one of the big people had entered quietly and had not cuffed him or fed him, but had picked him up to her breast and embraced him. She smelled good. Hot drops of water had fallen from her face to his. He had been scared and had wailed loudly in his fear. She put him down on the straw hurriedly and left the hut, fastening the door behind her. He remembered that moment, and he treasured it, just as he remembered the sweetness of a cabbage heart, the tart taste of plums, the crunch of apples, the greasy delight of roasted fish. And now he saw the faces in the firelight, all of them looking at him as he was led out from the hut for the first time, which was the only time. So that was what people looked like. Raised in darkness, he had never seen faces. Everything was so new, so strange. The bonfire light hurt his eyes. They pulled on the rope around his neck to lead him to a place where the man waited for him. And when the first blade was raised in the firelight, what a cheer went up from the crowd. The child from the darkness began to laugh with them, in delight and in freedom. And then the blade came down. Shadow opened his eyes and realized that he was hungry and cold, in an apartment with a layer of ice clouding the inside of the window glass. His frozen breath, he thought. He got out of bed, pleased he didn't have to get dressed. He scraped at a window with a fingernail as he passed, felt the ice collect under the nail, then melt to water. He tried to remember his dream, but remembered nothing but misery and darkness. He put on his shoes. He figured he would walk into the town center, walk across the bridge, across the northern end of the lake, if he had the geography of the town right. He put on his thin jacket, remembering his promise to himself that he would buy himself a warm winter coat, opened the apartment door, and stepped out onto the wooden deck. The cold took his breath away. He breathed in and felt every hair in his nostrils freeze into rigidity. The deck gave him a fine view of the lake, irregular patches of gray surrounded by an expanse of white. The cold snap had come, that was for sure. It couldn't be much above zero, and it wouldn't be a pleasant walk, but he was certain he could make it into town without too much trouble. What did Hinzelmann say last night? A 10-minute walk? And Shadow was a big man. He would walk briskly and keep himself warm. He set off south, heading for the bridge. Soon he began to cough, a dry, thin cough as the bitterly cold air touched his lungs. Soon his ears and face and lips hurt, and then his feet hurt. He thrust his ungloved hands deep into his coat pockets, clenched his fingers together, trying to find some warmth. He found himself remembering low-key Lie Smith's tall tales of the Minnesota winters, particularly the one about a hunter treed by a bear during a hard freeze who took out his dick and pissed an arching yellow stream of steaming urine that was already frozen hard before it hit the ground, then slid down the rock-hard frozen piss pole to freedom. A wry smile at the memory, and another dry, painful cough. Step after step after step. He glanced back. The apartment building was not as far away as he had expected. This walk, he decided, was a mistake, but he was already 3 or 4 minutes from the apartment, and the bridge over the lake was in sight. It made as much sense to press on as to go home. And then what, call a taxi on the dead phone, wait for spring? He had no food in the apartment, he reminded himself. He kept walking, revising his estimates of the temperature downward as he walked, -10, -20, -40 maybe, that strange point on the thermometer when Celsius and Fahrenheit say the same thing. Probably not that cold. But then there was wind chill, and the wind was now hard and steady and continuous, blowing over the lake, coming down from the Arctic across Canada. He remembered, enviously, the chemical hand and foot warmers. He wished he had them now. 10 more minutes of walking, he guessed, and the bridge seemed to be no nearer. He was too cold to shiver. His eyes hurt. This was not simply cold. This was science fiction. This was a story set on the dark side of Mercury, back when they thought Mercury had a dark side. This was somewhere out on rocky Pluto, where the sun is just another star